From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth is the new book from astrophysicist Adam Frank. And if you joined us last hour, or if you're listening on a podcast, it's easy to find the conversation with Adam about his book that connects climate change as an issue that we face here, but every alien civilization is facing or has faced. And he is the professor, along with a colleague, who created a mathematical formula, an updated version of the famous Drake equation, that tells us that the odds that we are the only technological civilization ever are roughly 1 in 10 billion trillion. I don't think I feel that lucky. And there are probably lots of civilizations out there. They all would face climate change as an issue as they grow. That's what we're facing, so we can feel some solidarity across the stars. And the book, I think, is really instructive as the challenge we face and what we can do going forward to sort of grow up and get serious about it. The book's remarkable. Adam is going to join us for this hour now, because I know you're always curious to know what the feedback's been. And you have been just about everywhere. I've heard you on NPR. I've heard you on every basic podcast there is. New York Times, you had a piece. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone you haven't done?
TV.
Fox News? Have you done Fox News?
Fox News, no, I have not done Fox
okay.
News. That would be fun. That would be fun.
Actually, I know that would be fun.
That would
you.
Be fun. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
But you're just about everywhere, and the feedback is, what's the feedback been like so far?
Pretty positive. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the question was sort of what would people respond to, and I thought there'd be a lot of response about the alien stuff, just in general, the alien stuff. And actually, the thing I've had more than anything is response, people sort of being like, thank you for giving me a way of thinking about climate change where, you know, it was not all guilt and you're a horrible person for breathing. And people responding also, the Joe Rogan in particular, because Joe Rogan has a very broad audience. And I had, a bunch of people reached out to me. I think it's very important to distinguish between climate deniers and, you know, who are just hardcore and they're into denial for, like, you know, has nothing to do with the science. And then people who just, you know, they may, whatever political reason, they might be a little more skeptical, but you can talk with them. They're up for a conversation, you know. And those people, I've had a bunch of conversations with those people that have been really hopeful, you know, because I gave them a way of talking about climate change that didn't sort of play into the usual
like the
polarization.
Self-flagellation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Also with us are people who are doing work in our community in various sectors on climate, in terms of activism, community education, and more. Karen Berger is an associate professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Rochester. Karen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Abby McHugh-Griffa is a member of the leadership team of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Abby, welcome back to the program to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And nice to meet Peter Collins, who's a volunteer for the Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester. And Peter, among others, instrumental in getting the town of Henrietta to support the carbon fee and dividend proposal, as described in by our own Beth Adams on WXXI in our coverage. So good work there. Congratulations for the work there, and thanks for being here, Peter.
Thank you.
And let me ask all of our guests, I know you had a chance to listen to the first hour, and I don't know anybody in our community who works on climate more than folks like you. So Abby, I'll start with you. What do you make of the themes in the book and what you heard in the last hour?
Okay, so first off, full disclosure, I have not read the book
yet.
Okay. I look forward to doing so, of course. But, you know, I really appreciated the conversation in the first hour. I found it very instructive. Of course, there were a lot of things mentioned that I completely agree with, especially that it's not about saving the planet. It's about saving the people on it, in particular, is who I'm concerned about. But, you know, I think what was most instructive to me about the first hour was it helped me appreciate why some people are still questioning the science. Because there were some things mentioned in the first hour that, frankly, were like sort of over my head, right? In terms of, you know, exoplanets and blah, blah, blah. Sorry for calling it blah, blah, blah.
It's all blah, blah, blah on one level.
and that idea of, you know, you were mentioning the thing about the firefly in the baseball stadium
yeah.
and being able to see that. That sounds impossible to me. And I know it's not because I appreciate and respect what scientists do in the scientific process. But I can see how that's really a stretch for many people, something that is just so, I mean, that's beyond even what you see in a lot of science fiction, you know, movies. So it helped me to get it a little more. And to then reflect on what do people actually need to know about climate change. And I know there's been a lot of research done out of Yale, the Center for Climate Communications, that really what it comes down to, people need to know that 97% of scientists agree. It's real, it's bad, it's us, but there is hope. So I always come back to that as a theme.
Okay. Karen, you want to reflect on some of what you heard first hour?
Yeah, I did have the opportunity to read the book, so I'm going to comment on a few things from the book as well as things that came up in the last hour. So first off, I really appreciate the way you say climate change it's not a question of what if, it's just a question of this is and how do we manage this difficult transition. And I thought the point you made in the last hour about it's not a problem to be solved, it's a transition to navigate, was a, again, more hopeful way of thinking about it, because we can see how increments can get us towards where we need to be going in the right direction. Another thing that resonated with me was your talk about our project Civilization as a cosmic teenager. So as the parent of two teenagers, I see how there are these challenges. And you talk about, you know, we have the keys to the planet, but we don't know what's going to happen. But one of the things that got me thinking about is that our teenagers will often see the impacts of their decisions. So whether they do poorly on a test because they stayed up too late, or they wreck the car, or they have a hangover, you know, they're going to see those impacts. And I think one of the challenges we have with climate change is that those of us with the keys do not necessarily see the impacts, either because they're happening somewhere else on the planet or because they're going to happen into the future. And I think one of the things for us to think about and engage about is how do we see those responsibilities and learn from it, even if those impacts aren't right in front of us.
Yeah, that's a great point.
That's so interesting, because I was just having a conversation the other day saying, what if no civilization survives this because of exactly that? Because we are so programmed to think long-term is 10 years.
Right.
And that we're just not going to be able to be that forward-thinking. Now, I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist that we will be able to do that. But boy, it's tough sometimes when people don't feel like they're seeing. Now, of course, you can look around the world and we are seeing results and we're feeling it. It doesn't rain for 6 weeks, and then you get a hurricane in Rochester like we had yesterday. Now, I'm not saying that's climate change. I know everyone wants to go nuts about weather and climate. But I think, Karen, that's really worth considering, how we get people to think long term.
Right. And again, what is that long term? I was hearing a colleague of mine this morning talking about 100 meter sea level rise as sort of the worst case scenario. And someone raised their hand and said, what time frame? And they said thousands of years. And I think for most of us in the room, we just said, impossible to think about. You know, where will we be? Who will we be? And how do we act now towards that future?
By the way, I was one of the people saying, we need rain eventually. We need rain. And I'm driving out of Rochester yesterday. A flying porta potty nearly hit my car right off of Lake Avenue. It probably dodged the front bumper by a few feet.
Wow.
That would have been.
That was not the rain you were looking for.
That would have been symbolic of something. Peter, what did you make of the first hour?
Well, I think Abby and Karen have already said a lot of it. One of the things that came to me as we were talking about this analogy with teenagers, and so this isn't directly from the book, but something I've heard in the past is the advice to the parents of teenagers that, you know, don't sweat the small stuff. Your job is to get them through this alive, get them through this transition alive. And so one of the reasons, I guess, that I'm a climate change volunteer is because, to me, a lot of what I read about in the paper is the small stuff, and I'm not so worried about that. I am concerned about getting not the planet, but the people through this transition alive, and I think that's important, and that's something we need to focus on. If we can get people to look for the long term and, you know, some of those other challenges that go with trying to make progress on climate change.
Let me go ahead and read an email from a listener, and I think this will connect to some of the feedback that Adam got from a recent piece you wrote for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And then I want to turn it over to the other panelists for their thoughts on this question of sort of guilt, the way we shame ourselves or others. An emailer writes, Evan, this is a pessimist here. Isn't it possible that humans will inevitably destroy their environment in order to survive, and why should we deserve to exist at all? Okay, I mean, I don't know that anybody says we deserve to exist. It's a question of we do exist, and do we want to continue? But that's sort of in that pessimistic group. We're destroying it. Do we deserve to exist? What was some of the feedback you got? Remind our listeners, when you wrote for the New York Times recently, the angle you chose to focus on and some of the feedback.
Yeah, so the angle was, you know, it's the title was sort of, it's not saving the planet, saving, you know, the Earth will survive, we may not. I think that was the headline they ran it with. And I got, you know, some people really liked it, and some people, you know, I got this feedback from sort of like, you know, you should feel guilty. Don't, you know, I got into an argument, a Twitter argument with somebody when it was, and I put explicitly in there, this view is not an excuse for ecological hooliganism. And I really love that experience of just, you know, dumping stuff in a river just because why not? I mean, you know, clearly if we're going to make it, the biosphere has to come with us. We rely on the biosphere. But that's sort of like, there's a way in which that sort of, you know, resolute shaming, what the person said there, that, you know, we're going to destroy the environment. We're not going to destroy the planet. We're going to change the planet in a way that's terrible for us, and the project of civilization will collapse. But the idea that we're going to lay waste to the planet.
Change versus destroy is an important distinction.
Yeah, destroy. We're not going to destroy the planet. We're going to destroy our ability for the civilization to function on the planet. And again, this doesn't take away from the fact that we're causing a lot of suffering to other animals, to other life forms. And, you know, that's not good either. But it's just that when we think, as I say, you know, it may be more important for us to get through climate change. It may be more important to save the phytoplankton in the ocean than save the bears, right? I mean, that may be, if you're going to have to weigh those out, you know, that may be a more important decision, is to save the bottom of the food chain than the. So, you know, in order to make it through, we're going to have to sort of think differently about it. So that guilt thing sort of, you know, what do they call it? Charismatic megafauna, right? You know, so polar bears are charismatic megafauna. And we all love to focus on them because they tug at our hearts because we love bears. You know, I love bears too. But it's, again, it's this way in which we get, our thinking is misplaced. And it takes, and the guilt too, that sort of, you know, oh, you're a terrible.
You think the guilt paralyzes people from action?
I was just at an interesting conference where a woman who was, worked for the World Wildlife Federation in the Mekong River, trying to, you know, help the Mekong River, the whole thing from the Himalayas, she was in Myelin. And she was talking about how they did this ad about the cheetah, and it showed sort of a cheetah running, and the numbers, you know, the ad showed the numbers of cheetah dropping as the cheetah was running. And she said, you know, when they actually, somebody went out and they hired someone to see how the ad was effective. And what they found is everybody turned it off, because all you were doing was re-traumatizing people. So it's like, it's on one level, this is just not effective, you know? It is not effective communication if you're trying to, and I'm interested in hearing what you guys think about this, because that's certainly what it seems to be. It's not like you give up we have responsibility.
You cheat and murdering.
Right,
but in a sense,
people,
some people are going to say, but we are. That's the reality. We got to suck it up and understand the impact now.
Right, but that's different. Look, the story you tell, this is my thing so much about the book, is what story are you telling? Right, and if you're telling a story that takes people, the first thing they're going to do is turn the TV off. You're telling the wrong story. You know, my perspective on the sort of astrobiological perspective on climate change. I think it's true. It just is true. But also, I think it's a much more helpful story. But the question is, will it be effective? You know, or as part of a whole bunch of other things. By itself, it's not going to do anything. But you know, as someone pointed out, stories are human beings' first technology. They're our original technology. So if we're telling the wrong story about climate change, then we can expect that we're going to get caught.
All right, so I want to turn to Abby first on this. And I think the first time we met on this program, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, you had an emotional moment on this program as a young mother.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to speak out of school. No. But I mean, because we've all, I hope, have had moments of emotion when we think about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. And you had this moment where you had this realization, you think about your children, and you think about what we're doing. And probably in that emotion is a feeling of either guilt or shame or embarrassment or concern. So that's probably a natural emotion if we're really getting our heads around it in a proper way. Is it effective? And how do you view Adam's concern about wielding that shaming as a way of educating and moving people to action?
So I think this is a really fascinating question. You know, how do we use different motivators? Essentially, that's what it comes down to move people to take action on climate. Because the reality is, we need to change things that we are currently doing. So we need to figure out how to motivate people to do that. And for the vast majority of people, I think, no, shame is probably not going to be the answer. You know, I think as a society, we tend to fall back on this good guy, bad guy storytelling. And in this particular case, there may be some bad guys we could point to, but, you know, are we all the bad guy? We all play a role. We have all contributed to this crisis, but I don't think that makes us bad or evil or anything along those lines.
What do you think when you hear Sir David Attenborough say, we are a plague on the earth and it's coming home to roost over the next 50 years?
I know that it's tricky. You know, would the Earth be better off without us? Maybe in some manner of speaking, perhaps. But I want to live here as a human. I want my children to have a livable planet to be part of. And I want them to be able to do it in cooperation with other people. And I think, you know, I really appreciate a lot of what Dr. Frank said about we need to find this way of living in cooperation with our biosphere. And then I would also just add to that, you know, it's really about cooperation between human beings. We are not going to solve this without figuring out how to cooperate. So pointing fingers is not likely to get us there. You know, I know, especially, you know, with the political dynamics these days, the divide, you know, partisan divide, we've got to get away from that, as this is Democrats versus Republicans. That's got to end, because it's not helping us. We need policy changes, and we're going to need both parties to work together toward that. So it's true for me personally, as a mother of two small children, protecting them is definitely my primary motivation. And it puzzles me enormously when I see other parents who maybe just they haven't realized yet the gravity of the situation and the threat to their children's future. You know, what Peter mentioned earlier about not sweating the small stuff. One thing that's been great about being involved in climate activism is there are so many things that to me at this point qualify as small stuff that just don't bother me. And that includes, like, is my house clean? I don't care. I don't care. I'm trying to save the world, you know? So it helps for me to put things in perspective. And then the actual shame question, I know I have been guilty of shaming people, my own family especially, I'm embarrassed to admit, you know, because when people have already heard this message, you know, when they've been told repeatedly, like, you know, what you're doing right now is detrimental to your grandchildren's future, and they continue to do it, that I find very, 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 very difficult to take as the mother who's working really hard to try to protect her children. So it's tough, and I don't know the answers, but fortunately I think social science does give us a lot of these answers, and there are people out there doing really good work to help guide us in those decisions.
So you mean, in other words, when you think about, say, it's a family member, mm-hmm. and you're frustrated, it takes a lot of patience for you to continue to say to them, I want you to know what you're doing is contributing to the harming of the future for our kids and their kids and their kids and their kids. But we can do this together. There are ways through this together, and we can unleash everybody's creativity and power together, and we can actually find a positive, as opposed to just being like, I can't believe I'm having this conversation with you again. You obstinate.
Yeah, so
it's
I wish
every day is Thanksgiving with you.
I wish that I could say that I took that reasonable, measured approach
it's hard.
In every conversation. I have not. I've definitely gone ballistic on people, you know, just in terms of...
Has it changed any minds?
No, probably not. Probably not.
Does it make you feel better later?
Oh... Maybe to some extent, you know, it depends. And I think there, you know, shame has played a role in our culture, the development of our civilization. You know, the reason people don't steal in general is not necessarily because they don't want the things that are sitting right there that somebody else has. For many people, shame does help keep us in line. So, I mean, we got to be strategic about changing social norms. Right now, you know, the normal thing is to waste energy. The normal thing is to buy the huge gas-guzzling vehicle. So we've got to change those norms. And then for the people who continue to do that and put our children and grandchildren at risk, then maybe we can think about strategic use of shame.
We'll take some of your phone calls in our second half hour. I see the phone starting to ring. Do you want to respond a little to what you heard from Adam?
No, I just think, you know, everything she's saying is really interesting, right? It's how do we personally navigate a lot of this? Because, you know, there are choices that we make as individuals, and then we have people that we have to interact with. And, you know, I think a lot about this, you know, since in my role as a public scientist, how I interact with people. You know, I'm always, I was amazed by Carl Sagan. No matter who Carl Sagan talked to, he was always... you know, cool about it. And he, you know, treated everybody with respect. And that's the way I'd like to sort of approach. I mean, sometimes with like really hardcore climate denialists, you know, it's particularly difficult because they're so willfully ignorant, you know, of what they're talking about. Like they make these claims about climate change. They don't even know. They haven't bothered to. But, you know, for what I really find is there's so many people in the middle, right, who like sort of because maybe they came from, you know, Republican families and they've heard that they should be against climate. But if you approach them with a different approach, you know, like this idea like climate change shows, you know, triggering climate change shows how awesome we are. Suddenly it's like they can hear it, you know. But if we don't do something now, and I do think there are, you know, definitely organized climate denial is they should have shame, right? You know, so triggering climate change is something we were all part of, the project of civilization. And that wasn't our fault. We didn't do it on purpose because we were just adopting a new energy modality. But the people who have sort of like worked to keep us from recognizing and doing something, as I like to say, they are the folly that will keep us from reaching our higher potential. And so there is, you know, those are people that you can point to and say, hey, man, you're really keeping us from...
Well, let me follow up with that before we get to Karen and Peter on this and again, your phone calls as well. Do you agree with Adam's construction of thinking about this, that triggering climate change is actually a sign of how awesome our civilization has been? Do you agree with that?
I think humans are amazing, capable of amazing good and amazing folly. I think folly is a good word for it. You know, as a human being, I think each of us needs to strive to do more good and do less folly / bad, whatever you want to call it. I know for myself, I need hope. I need hope to be able to keep doing this work every day. If I thought it was hopeless, I don't know how I would spend my time, but I wouldn't spend it, you know, being a climate organizer. That's for sure. I don't know if that's for sure. I'm not sure what I would do. Life would be different. So helping people maintain that hope, see what the path forward is. We need to know how to move forward in order to be able to move forward. And at this point, so many people just don't have the information they need, really basic information about what the problem is and how what the solutions are, even more importantly.
Can I just ask this? This is one thing, you know, because I often find that even, and this is something that's been such the debate, you can give people the information mm-hmm. and they won't hear it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been showing people that chart of the, you know, the mm-hmm. hockey stick diagram. And they just, you know, because of their whatever background, they filter it out. And there's all the work on cognitive mm-hmm. biases. So that's why I think the story matters so much. Mm-hmm. It's not just giving people the, because we've been giving them the information for years now. So it's got to be the underlying story that changes so that it can be, that's that information gets couched in a new way. Because we've been 30 years showing them that diagram, and it's just for a certain percent of the population. I mean, there's been almost no change, right, in the number of people who think climate change is a serious problem in the last 30 years. It's been a slight uptick down, but we, you know, and so there's clearly something about the messaging, about the story we're telling, which has reached a bunch of people, 52%, but the others, it's just not reaching, and showing them that chart again is not going to change it. So. That's what I worry about.
Let me get Rich in Rochester, who wants to weigh in on what he's hearing in this part of the conversation. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good.
There's two. They made me think of another idea, but I think sometimes we're sort of disingenuous in our approaches because we each and every single one of us contribute to this situation, and we only want to give up the things we want to give up. Usually it's things that don't affect us too much every day. Our air conditioning, it's hot right now. It's hot as hell, for the lack of a better word. And we all want our air conditioning. And so we're willing to do those things. But the other thing that I want to talk about is our messaging. I think climate change and the idea, like I always hear things like saving the earth. The reality is, if you want to reach those other people, you have to give them a reason to. You have to tell them the cost it's going to take to move water. We're not going to lose water on this earth. The amount of water on the earth is the same. But tell them what it's going to take to do the things we do every day, that our damming system isn't going to work because there won't be water in the mountains. So now we're going to have to transport water. Your water is going to cost more. This is more about humanity. The earth doesn't care. Species come and go. The earth doesn't care about it, but we have to talk to the human side of this. And what does it mean for humanity, each and every one of those people? And I think the problem with the messaging in the environmental movement, it's always talking about saving the earth. We need to talk about saving the world for what we want it for, because that's the reality of it.
Hmm. Rich, thank you. Abby, what do you think?
Agreed.
That was easy. Rich, you think you're on the same page there, it sounds like.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's not what people hear from the messaging. The messaging is save the world. What do you mean save the world? The world's going to be here. So we have to talk to people at the level of, listen, do you want to pay instead of 0.22 cents a gallon of water? Do you want to start paying $2 a gallon of water because the amount of water it's going to take to transport it or desalinate it because it's not in the mountains? We have to break it down to that level. Stop talking about the earth and talk about them in their lives every day.
Hmm.
Okay. You know, I think you bring up a very good point about talking about the costs. And so a good example of that is what happened in California when they had the recent heat wave. There was actually a study a couple of years ago that said California is not going to be able to meet their air conditioning demands when there's a heat wave. And in fact, what happened last week is tens of thousands of people lost electricity when temperatures were in triple digits. And the more we can bring that information out, and that sort of gets back to the stories that we tell and the messaging that we bring, and that we don't guilt people into that, but we give them those pathways to say, okay, if we're worried about this, let's not say we're going to take away your air conditioning because we don't want to do that, but let's think about what money can we then spend to invest in alternative energy sources or better insulation or strategies that bring collateral benefits to the actions that we're trying to do to help make us more resilient.
Let me grab one more phone call, and because I think we're leading into what does work. The question is, what have our guests seen change minds? And when I say change minds, by the way, I'm really thinking in two ways. Yes, I'm thinking of the full-on deniers who don't accept the scientific evidence, but I'm also thinking of the people who accept that but don't really feel moved to action either in their daily lives or supporting policy because they feel someone either paralyzed or in this kind of period of stasis or thinking that there's just no way to kind of get out ahead of it. So what does motivate change is a big part of it. And Jack in Rush has an idea on that. Go ahead, Jack.
Well, I learned this a number of years ago, and I forget which class I was in, and they talked about what Australia was trying to do to get people to wear seatbelts to prevent the number of injuries and deaths in highways. And they kept showing all these movies of gory people, and nothing was working until they put a heavy, stiff fine on not wearing seatbelts. So what motivated them was the cost out of their pocketbooks, not whether they were going to, you know, be healthy going forward or kill other people.
Sure. And Jack, if you can stay there for a second, I mean, I remember having a conversation with economist Kent Gardner probably a few years back. And he said, look, as an economist, if you want to motivate behavior on climate, put a big tax on gasoline. You know, we know how to motivate people's behavior. But then, of course, Kent said, just wait for the calls that Big Brother is trying to run your life. You know, that is sort of inevitably a companion to that kind of a thing. But certainly it's more effective. So I think that you're Jack, thank you for that phone call. I think Jack's raising a point of what did work in one case with a seatbelt. But yeah, that motivates behavior. I mean, on the policy side of things, that probably has a place, Karen?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why CCL's work on carbon fee and dividend is so important, that until we internalize the cost of what we're doing to the planet, you're not going to see any action. I think you will find some do-gooders, like the people in this room and many of the people listening, who will take action. But it really does take that economic hit to internalize that.
What do you think, Peter?
Well, of course, that's what CCL is working towards, is the carbon fee and dividend, the dividend being an important part there. So, the original discussions of a big fee on carbon-based energy, the immediate reaction is, oh, then the government's taken my money again. So our plan is to have a dividend where all of that money is returned back to the public in the form of a monthly dividend shared equally among households based on the number of adults there. And we do a lot of tabling at events. We go out, set up a table, talk to people. And I think there are some things that help. Now, with the absolute climate deniers, it's often hard to get through. About the best we can do is with maybe the people who say, well, there might be some change, but I'm not sure it's humans. We can always talk about the fact that, you know, it doesn't really matter how much is human caused and how much is not human caused. If you agree that something is happening, then let's talk about what we might do to at least reduce the effects of that. For other people, it's a matter of, as Abby was talking about, hope. You know, many people say, yep, I think there's climate change, but what can I do about it? And so we talk about the political process and the fact that now we actually have 86 U.S. Congressional representatives, 43 Democrats and 43 Republicans who have signed on to the Climate Solutions Caucus. And that kind of thing gives us hope. And then there's talking through, a lot of it's the fear of, well, but if we make this big change, what's going to happen? You know, I'm afraid that I'm going to lose my job. And we talk about our economic studies that show that there would actually be more jobs. And so combination of strategies to help talk to people about this.
Sure. Adam Frank, there's something called the backfire effect, where just shoving more evidence at someone doesn't always work and can actually strengthen their negative view of something. What have you seen that works?
Well, like I said, so since the book has come out, I really find, so, you know, like that person who comes to you and says, well, I think there's an effect, but it's not us. So this idea of saying, no, actually it is us, but it shows us how awesome we are. You can get them, right? You can really get them. It's like, no, it's human beings, but it's, you know, instead of being like, yeah, it's us. Wow, we're terrible. Instead saying like, look, we built this world-girdling civilization. This is part of this enormous transition into our maturity. It's been American business, which has led the way. It's been American innovation, which has led the way. Suddenly those people are like, yeah, I love American business. I love American innovation, you know? And suddenly if it's not couched as this thing of like, yes, we're doing it and we're terrible, then suddenly, you know, you've got this avenue for them to see, sort of like, yeah, it is us. That's okay, right? And we just, and then the other thing I like to point out to people, you know, who say, what about my job? You know, I'm, so this is something I'm learning about, but I think for most people, they're not even going to know, right? I mean, how many of us actually work in petroleum-related industries, right? I mean, so for most people, you're going to have a different kind of car. You're going to have a different kind of, you know, your electricity is going to come from somewhere else. Rather, but, you know, when I think about the other transitions, energy transitions we made, right? So as I point out here, in 1890, there were no gas stations, right? In 1920, there were gas stations everywhere. So, you know, for the average person, they didn't know suddenly there were gas stations and now you were supposed to drive a car. I don't think, you know, there's going to be a large fraction of people who will not notice this transition.
How about the fact that we're all holding these smartphones?
Yeah.
I mean, 10 years ago, finally they were on the scene. But 2007, they really hit the scene?
Yeah.
In a decade, if you don't have one, I mean, we are trying to find ways that people living in poverty can have them because they're so necessary to basic ideas of work, travel, communication, et cetera.
So that's why
that's
I think,
10 years.
Yeah. So I think this is sort of idea that, like, you know, I don't know the research on this, but it recently occurred to me when I think about human technological innovation that there's going to be a pretty large section of the population that will not even know that we made the transition. Because really, fundamentally, and this is what I like to point out to people, it really is about changing energy infrastructures. Like, at the baseline, that's what it's really about. And that happens at such a high level, right? Requires that, you know, it's sort of independent about whether or not you even recycled. It's about, you know, needing to vote and being involved in, everybody should recycle, but I'm just saying that there's a level at which this transition is going to happen, is going to flow through at the, you know, the highest levels of how we organize ourselves. And that's really about, you know, that's why I'm so happy to hear about what happened with Henrietta, right? This is about from the town level up. Right? Making sure that we are electing people who understand this and that we're building resilient, adaptive systems with new energy structures from that, you know, town, county.
Brighton or Henrietta? It was the...
We've had a number of the towns now that have signed on. Henrietta's the latest one.
Oh, okay. See, look at that.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So, like, you know, people can be involved. I was at a conference not long ago, and somebody was, you know, a student was responding like, oh, my God, they were so depressed about everything that was happening. What can I do? You know, everybody tells me to vote, but, you know, is that it? And it's like, well, no, actually, you can vote almost every day. There's always a meeting, you know. The Brighton Town Board is going to be having a meeting about that's going to have some energy-related something or other. So it's not the idea that you vote every 4 years, or once every 4 years.
But I still struggle to believe that I'm going to hear at the next really interesting public event, Abby McHugh Griffa making the point that we changed the climate and that actually is proof of our awesomeness.
I don't know. I could be sold on that. You know, I want to hear
works.
I'm awesome just as much as anyone else.
Right.
You know, but I think the other thing it really comes down to is this focus on systems level change versus individual change.
Yeah,
for many years, we've been telling people that they need to, you know, do X, Y, and Z, change their light bulbs, you know, eat less meat, whatever it is, without really talking about the structural issues behind this. And so that's, for example, why RPCC is advocating for community choice aggregation, because we don't want people to have to think about where their energy's coming from. We want renewables to just be the default option. Rather than, you know, you have to go out of your way to get it and you have to pay more for it, it should cost less and be super ultra easy, so easy that you don't even know it's happening. So those kinds of systems level changes is really where we feel we need to be focusing our attention as a climate movement at this point.
I wonder if you called it community energy choice. Community choice aggregation sounds a little wonky.
It does sound wonky, doesn't it? It is wonky.
But I think that's a really great point, because the problem, I mean, leading to this whole thing about when we talk about guilt, like people feel like every decision, like, oh, I was going to reach for that. Oh, I can't reach for that. I'm a terrible person. You know, it's like almost by breathing there's too many choices, and the morality of every choice seems to overwhelm us. But it has to happen sort of at this higher level where, like, right, it's just sort of, you know, we have the ability, the communities have the ability to organize in a way where it's the default choice. You have to opt out, actually, of the green alternative. And so that people don't have this sort of burden that every move they make has, you know, consequences for saving the world.
Yeah,
you know?
And I would just say on the subject of if there was a tax on gasoline, if there is a carbon fee and dividend, if there is policy, to the notion that, well, that's just the government. The government is us. We choose the representatives.
Right.
So I don't really have a whole lot of patience for. I mean, I understand the government can be heavy-handed, or can be. And listen, if you own a business and you feel like it's over-regulatory, I'm not at all saying the government can't be a little clumsy. But generally, the government is who we choose.
Right.
It's us. And if we choose a government that wants to deal with this in a policy way, maybe that makes more sense. Let me read Jenna's comment on Twitter. She says, "Can you ask your guests if this statement is true? And what we can do about it if it is." And it's a quote. It says, "Just a reminder, the vast majority of people bear no responsibility regarding climate change. 71% of carbon emissions come from just 100 companies. The average person's personal behavior bears no consequence on climate change. We can't end the crisis by recycling more." I don't know if the numbers there are true or not. Jenna is asking, generally speaking, if that's true. I don't know. Is the answer.
I know the numbers are striking. I'm not sure if that exact figure is it, but it's true that the vast majority of our personal carbon footprints are inherent in the products we buy. And if you don't have many choices, if all of the products that are on the shelves are made, you know, from fossil fuels and, you know, the extractive economy, what are you going to do as a consumer? What are you going to do, especially when the eco-friendly option does cost significantly more? And I think it becomes this issue of privilege. To be an environmentalist ends up being, if only rich people can afford it, that's problematic.
That's a huge point.
And I would agree with a point that Jenna raises in that quote about we're not going to solve the problem by recycling.
Yeah.
You know, it always frustrates me when I say I do environmental science and people say, well, I recycle. And that is, again, that is the small stuff. And that's not going to get us to the systems change. And I think the point that she brings up about these companies, you know, it's looking at what those companies are producing. And again, it comes back to policy, so that if we have a government that supports energy efficient technology regulations or provides subsidies for public transportation, we're going to be able to get those products from those companies that are going to have less of an environmental impact.
I have a deluge of phone calls to get through. Let me read an email and then we'll take a bunch of calls and we'll see what our listeners think. By the way, the reason we're here today is Adam Frank's new book is out. It's called Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. And it links climate change as a challenge that we face here to other alien civilizations, of which, if you look at the stats, and he provides a formula for you, there are almost certainly many that have been there facing the same challenges. This is our moment to decide, how long are we going to be here? Are we going to create a world for our kids and their kids and their kids for a long time to come? This is the challenge we now have to face. Linda says, in this polarized arena we live in, there is no place for shame in the discussion of climate change or any topic for that matter. If we look at a different issue, has shame worked to convince a person with pro-choice views? All of us have to stop acting as if any of us have the moral high ground and intellectual superiority. No one wants to feel less than. That's from Linda. I agree that no one wants to feel less than. I think we all make our own choices for our values and what our morals are. And, you know, Adam is intellectually superior to me. I'm okay with saying that. I have no problem with understanding my own inferiority. But Linda, I take the general point of the email, and I appreciate that. Let me work through a pile of your calls. We'll do it kind of quick, and then we'll let our panel respond because there's a lot of different subjects. So if you're on the phone, we're just going to kind of go down the line, and you can let us know what you think. We'll start with Herman in Brighton. Go ahead, Herman. That's not Herman. That's somebody else on line one. That's Pat in Parenton, I bet. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Hi, I just have a quick question since you got the scientists there, and that is, when I drive a paved road in the summer and I go through a segment that has all these trees, I can see the temperature on my car drop. And so I'm just wondering, with all the paving of America, if planting some trees doesn't help. I just wondered if it does anything.
Pat, thank you for the phone call. I don't know.
Yes, absolutely. And it works for roads. It works for rivers where they're trying to protect fish. All sorts of places. Trees make a difference.
Awesome. And I know Greentopia is on this mission to plant thousands, a thousand new trees, and they're trying to raise money to do it. That's just one small example. But, Pat, thank you for that. Herman is on, too. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. Hi, Evan, and hi, Abby. There's a bigger problem that I don't think has been addressed here, and that is that the correct scientific message about global warming is being actively opposed by a well-funded and well-organized effort. And on top of that, there has been fostered in the public mind a denigration of expertise and this idea that experts are expert opinions are suspect. Didn't you, Evan, didn't you have a guest on by the name of Tom Nichols who wrote a book about that?
Yeah.
And the idea that that somebody that has no expertise, let's say a talk show host or something, should be given the same or greater credibility as a scientist who has studied the issue all their life.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And that makes it very, very easy with that general, you know, attitude towards expertise and so on. That makes it very easy for demagogues to sow doubt in the public mind about these issues. So those things need to be addressed because they are working against us. It's not just our messaging. It's addressing the whole bigger issue of the denigration of expertise and B, the actual active demagoguery that's being funded and being organized to mislead people.
Herman, thank you. Yes, the book is called The Death of Expertise by Tom Nichols. I'll just give you my brief take as a non-expert talk show host, as Herman points out, and then I'll let our expert guest jump in. No, Herman's right here. And from my perspective, and listening to people like Tom who have studied this, there is a real active denigration campaign going on among some political leaders that think they could take advantage of a public that doesn't trust experts anymore. And there's a real social and political and societal cost to that. And we're seeing that play out in various ways. I think it's dangerous. I think we need to find a way to get back to trusting experts and really valuing expertise and saying, I don't know, and looking for answers from maybe others who have worked harder on a problem than we have. But I also think when you look at Adam Frank's points about how we communicate with the public, some of what Adam is modeling, and this is where I get a little expertise as a talk show host, because I've studied how people change minds and converse and guard their own opinions and maybe open up to other ideas. We come generally, everything is unfortunately politicized. Climate change has become politicized, whether we want it or not. So the right-left political spectrum, people on the left are a little bit more worried about collective harm, collective action, impact you could probably think of three or four attributes. On the right, there's more of a concern about individual opportunity, individualism, opportunity for innovation, et cetera. And so when you want to argue about this or when you want to convince somebody, you got to figure out where is someone's value core and can I come at this from a way that resonates more with them? Because if you come from a collectivist point of view to someone who wants to champion the individual, they have got a big wall up and they're probably not interested at all. I think Adam kind of gets around this attack the experts endgame and says, hey, we changed the climate, which is probably a mark of how impressive we are. He says, awesome. I'm going to use the word impressive. That's an impressive thing to change a whole planet's climate. We're pretty impressive. Can we do it again? Or can we find a different way? Can we be that impressive to change that?
Right.
That is more appealing. And I think that's what you and your book and your message is doing. But I think there's a real risk in attacking expertise, as you've said too, right?
Yeah. I think just briefly, and then I'll let other people chime in on this. I just think, you know, part of the problem with the, you know, save the planet, the guilt thing is it actually plays into the denialists' script, right? They want us to be in that position. They want us to be the tree hugging, oh, you know, you're a snowflake, oh, you care about the little bunnies, you know, and so this sort of idea like, no, American business is awesome, you know, American ingenuity is awesome. It just sort of like blunts it, you know. Again, I think it's also true, but it also, you know, there's a way, there has been, I mean, an organized and very effective, very well-funded climate denial movement, which has used the skepticism towards expertise in a very dangerous way for all of us and all, you know, things that go, you know, it's vaccines, it's, you know, it just
spiral. It was lead in the 60s, it was smoking in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, It's amazing. Big industry has its way of attacking science.
Yeah, right. And they took that playbook. So I think, you know, we have to be very careful about the fact that not playing into their script and actually flipping the script on them, where they're the ones going like, bleh.
Yeah, you go, don't you like American business?
That's what I'll say.
Don't you like innovation?
That's what I'll say. Yeah, yeah. I'll say, don't you like the American military? It was the American military that did Camp Century, that dragged a nuclear reactor out onto Greenland so we could drill down and find the temperature record for the last 10,000 years. And, you know, American servicemen died. You know, they were in really harsh conditions. So it's like, come on. Where your loyalties lie.
Okay. Abby, does that work for you? What do you make of Herman's concern about attacking the experts?
First of all, I really appreciate that Herman brought that up because it is an important part of the conversation. And yes, it is true. For anyone who wants to dig into that a little more, I'd recommend checking out the documentary Merchants of Doubt. It outlines it pretty clearly and helps us all understand like why we are confused about this, because we have been deliberately misled. So again, when it comes back to that shame thing, we can't shame people for not understanding because we have been deliberately misled. So that's an important point. And then also this goes back to, you know, in the first hour, there was a caller who asked a question or made a point about whether we talk about this as an issue of values or through more of a scientific lens. And you know, I think different messages are going to resonate with different audiences, but certainly talking about this as through the values lens allows us to identify what are our shared common concerns. Because, you know, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat, you probably value your friends, your family, the place where you grew up fishing, whatever it is. You know, so to dig down a little deeper, And figure out what do we have in common in terms of values, and how can we rally around that to move forward with implementing our awesomeness as humans to solve this problem.
Let me grab a couple other phone calls. I know our time's starting to run short here, so let's move quickly. Nick in Webster. Next, go ahead, Nick.
Hey, I'm not an expert in anything, but I'm a believer in shame to a degree, and I think it's a healthy thing. Scott Pruitt should be ashamed to say that our air and our water are too clean and don't need to be as clean as it is. But I just want to point something out and then make a challenge. You know, the Neolithic Revolution was a time when they went from hunter-gatherer in our food resources to agriculture and controlling our own food supply. And we are still hunter-gatherers of our energy resources. We dig in the ground, the oil, the coal, the other stuff. It's still pretty primitive when you think about it. We figured that food thing out thousands of years ago, but we're still hunter-gatherers for our energy resources. And I've been trying to coin a word that describes it. You know, Neolithic Revolution sounds good. I couldn't think of one. I wanted to be the one to coin this phrase, but I think it would be good to have it in our vocabulary for people who just insist on being primitive like that. And it's a little embarrassing when you think about it. Oh, I'm a hunter-gatherer. You know, if you said that about a culture, you'd think that they were primitive people. They're still hunter-gatherers. We're, you know, technology-oriented. If they're hunter-gatherers, it's a pejorative. But we are hunter-gatherers of our energy resources still, and we need to become farmers of our energy resources. And we need a term that we can use that everybody recognizes. So when somebody says, oh, I think we should still dig coal, who do we know that said that? You know? But, you know, we still need to have oil. We still need to, you know, go back to whale oil. You know, we have to have a name that gives that scientific, responsible sound to it.
I don't know what it would be, but any thought, Karen? You got a big smile on your face.
Well, I'm just thinking that'll be a good project for the students in my energy class because I love this analogy you have that we are hunting and gathering our energy sources, and that we need to have this distributed stationary energy generation through, and that it's about new implementation of new technologies, and that's where that innovation and awesomeness is going to come in. So, come back in a year and we'll see what ideas we have for you on new words for that.
Peter.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and I like that that analogy too, and. I think one of the things that I believe in, and kind of to Adam's point about American industry and American capitalism, I believe that our system can change and can find new, better means of supplying energy, but the incentives have to be right. And that's what's wrong now. As we've said, the forms of energy that are releasing the most carbon are often the cheapest. We can change that. You know, a carbon fee and dividend, we can make it so that the incentives are there to come up with new and better forms of energy, and we can do it. We can.
Charles in Rochester called in to say he thinks part of the reason people are ignorant about climate change is because they think there will just be some kind of technological advancement that will eventually solve it. We don't have enough evidence to think that we can pull enough carbon out of the atmosphere to get there, do we right now?
No. No, that technology waiting around is just for that. Not there.
Waiting yeah. for, what is it, waiting for Godot? Godot,
yeah, right. Yeah. Energy Godot.
and waiting for Energy Godot there for Charles. Don't wait forever. So some final thoughts here, maybe 30 seconds apiece. I'll go around the room here. Abby?
Okay, so just following up on that, the solutions exist today. We can implement them today. And for anyone out there who's looking to take action on this, there's lots of local opportunities to get involved. Citizens Climate Lobby, Color Bright and Green, certainly Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Look us up online and take action. Best antidote to depression, I find.
How do I find you online?
ROCPCC.org.
Okay.
I would say for feeling paralyzed by guilt or inaction or helplessness, this is a story to tell. Read Adam's book and think about this conversation of how we use everything that we've achieved so far for positive means moving forward.
Peter.
I think that we need to understand we don't have to change everything we do, but let's start by changing something that we do. Take those steps, whatever those steps are.
Adam Frank, the book has got a lot of people talking. It's Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and the Fate of the Earth. And, sometimes I ask authors, well, if the book is successful, what will change? Yours is like, if the book is successful, we'll live another million years.
<That's right. laughs>
Like, it's just no small thing here.
That's right. And we'll end up going into the solar system and settling the solar system. See, that's what I think is the end result of all this. That's the prize at the end.
All right. So the last question for you, 30 seconds. You have felt the same frustration that Abby and some others have expressed when you feel like you've hit a wall with someone. What have you tried to change about yourself going forward with the way you communicate with people?
One thing is just listen. Listen for a while, not feel like I have to step over them. And that's what I've found in these conversations I've had since the book has come out, is to really listen to people. And even if I can just a little bit, just like sort of open up and connect as human beings. Like, no matter what, we're not political on the other side, or opposed. We're basically two human beings having a conversation. And that at least helps a little bit no matter what the outcome is.
There is going to be some commonality somewhere.
Right.
Find it. Work together, small steps, everyone linking arms, and fascinating stuff. Thank you. The book is Light of the Stars, available now, just about everywhere that books are sold, and some places where books aren't even sold, you'll find. It's just remarkable. Congratulations. Let's talk soon.
Okay.
It's always fun.
Thank you.
Abby McHugh Griffa, nice to see you as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
Karen Berger, nice to have you back. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Peter Collins, who is working with the Citizens Climate Lobby of Rochester. So that's another organization. A lot of chances for you to work in our own communities. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks to all the feedback. If we didn't get your calls or emails, hang with it. Just a ton today. It was great. Rob Braden, engineer. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow.